Welcome to Cover Girls, Drinking and Overthinking, in which we take a story we love and analyze how well it was adapted.
I'm Chris.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Allison. Join us as we meticulously pick apart our favorite stories until no stone is left unturned. It'll be bookish.
It'll be boozy.
It'll be bantersome.
And it won't be boring. So grab a drink and get ready to overthink. Let's dig in. What if I just left this in?
I think some of this could go in.
Yes.
Don't you love that page turning, you avid readers?
Okay. I feel like Nanny Fran.
Who is Nanny Fran?
Really? The nanny. Fran Drescher.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh, I just never heard her called the nanny.
Yes, Mr. Sheffield.
Turn those pages. Okay, ew, this is so gross. All right. Welcome back to Cover Girls. We are so excited to be with you again. How's everyone feeling?
Amazing. Ready to get into this.
Yep. Ready to, well, we said dig in last time. We'll figure something else out.
Okay, just chime in when you think of a good pun. I'm here for it.
I'm ready for the whole book. Nope.
Okay. Well, and so we're not doing the whole book with you guys today, but in this episode, you can expect us to cover the first 50 pages, which is, ooh, some ASMR for you here, which is the first 10 first 9 chapters, if you're reading along. So I think that's actually technically 48 pages. So that's what we'll cover today. And those of you who tuned in last week would have heard us finishing the movie. So we're excited to dive into the book and see what differences there are and what's the same, which there's a surprising amount that is the same, which we will get into. But let's just do a quick check-in. I feel like our listeners probably don't know that much about us. And I just kind of want to hear just a little bit about everyone's day.
Well, you know how my day was.
That's true.
So Allison and I are together at my house. We have had an amazing weekend. On Friday night, we saw Taylor Swift in Arlington.
Oh, is that what you're doing up there?
Yes.
I was wondering.
Which for you guys, this will probably be released like months from now. So this will be old news. But yeah, we saw her in Arlington on maybe what, like her third week performing?
Yeah.
On tour?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was so enchanting.
Oh gosh.
So the lucky
enchanting.
Ones. Yeah. Yeah. You see what I did there?
Yeah.
We just had such a ball, a mirror ball, if you will. Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. She didn't sing Mirror Ball, so you don't
know.
No, get to
and
see
I was
that.
Really devastated, actually. That is my favorite on Folklore next to This Is Me Trying. Love those songs. Anyway, we're unashamed, unabashed Swifties.
Call us basic. We don't care.
Yeah, sure. I'm a basic white girl. I'll take it. That's fine.
And I have never heard of any of these songs before.
You're so much cooler than us.
You're not basic like us.
I only listen to indie bands that are cheap enough to be invited to ACL, so it's kind of a moot point anyway.
Yeah, we probably haven't heard of them, right?
Yeah, they only headline at ACL, so.
Yeah. How was your day, Kristen?
Busy. I've been working all this weekend doing murder mysteries and princess gigs, just gigging constantly. So,
ooh.
Yep. Killing people, taking pictures, same old,
taking
same
names.
Old. Yep. That's me.
We love to be working.
Smiling
yeah.
with the children and then stabbing people in the back.
Ooh. All right. Well, I'm super excited to share what we're drinking. Chris and I are drinking the same thing. I'll reveal that in a minute. But Kristen, what are you drinking for today's first book episode?
Well, today, like I said, my schedule has been hectic. So today, I've mixed myself up a complex little drink known as a Diet Dr. Pepper. It's got 23 different flavors in it, and I added them all, but I won't tell you what they are.
That is complex.
Sounds tasty.
It's
refreshing.
So complex. Yeah, it's so complex, I don't know what a single one of those 23 flavors are.
We'll take it. Okay, so Chris and I are having, I'm very excited to announce, we have named this drink dirty, rotten, pig-stealing great-grandfather.
Yes!
Thank you. And what it is an old-fashioned, because it's his grandfather.
Yes, it's his great-grandfather, yep.
And it's made with Whistle Pig's piggyback rye whiskey.
God dang, that's good.
It's so delicious.
Tell them who made it, Chris.
So my husband, Jordan, he used to be a bartender. He was a bartender for like 6 years, managed a bar while he was getting through college. And so he made, and he's also a bourbon like connoisseur. So
can I tell them how many bottles of bourbon he has?
Yes.
This is just a guesstimate from looking in their three different cabinets that have bourbon in them. I would guess he has at least 150 bourbon bottles. Am I crazy?
That's a lot of bourbon.
Bourbon slash whiskey. Is that about right?
No.
Is it more?
That's generous. I would say he has at least 80.
Okay.
Only 80.
Yeah. We are running out of room. And I have told him that. But he's only bought some of it. A lot of it has been gifted. He comes from a family that really cherishes their bourbon. He's from Louisiana, so they like to drink.
And he has a lot of collectibles too. I mean, at least half those bottles cost over like $60 or $70, right?
Yeah. So fun story. He was gifted a very rare bottle of bourbon. It's a Willett Reserve. And I think it was a small batch. And he saved it until his first child was born. So it was worth like $2,000. And at any point I was like, you know, you could sell that. Like, I mean, that's a pretty penny, or you could hold on to it and it could probably keep going up in value. And when my daughter was born, our daughter, he was like, no, good bourbon is meant to be enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Like that's adorable. The point of it. Yeah. And so he opened it when we got home from the hospital, and I tried it too, because I could drink finally. It was really good.
I was going to ask, did you at least get to have some?
I did. Yes. So yeah, that's probably his most valuable bottle, I would say. Still have it.
I read something on Instagram the other day that was like, life is too short. Take out the fancy candles. Take out like the china. Use the china. Use this, you know? And I struggle with saving expensive or nice things or collectibles for the quote unquote right moment. Mm-hmm. And that's a great example of like, yeah, it's super expensive and it'll be gone once you drink it. But what better occasion than celebrating the birth of your first child?
Exactly. We've got to enjoy what we have while we have it, right? And while we can.
So amen.
Beautiful. Yes.
Let's enjoy the first 48 pages of this book.
Amen.
I think Kristen had a few notes before we start.
Oh, so I just wanted to point out, I feel like probably if anybody has, for people who have been listening to this podcast, I'm sure that they know this already, but it's worth pointing out that the author of the book, Lewis, I think we decided on Saker. I'm going to go with Saker.
I think it's Sakar.
I think that's Sakar.
No, maybe that would have two C's.
Lewis S. is what I'm going to call. Lewis S.
Good old
S-A-C-H-A-R.
Oh, yeah.
Good old Lewis. Lewis, to his friends, not only wrote the book, Holes, but also was either the main or sole adapter / writer of the screenplay. So I was thinking about it, and at first I thought, well, that's kind of the worst possible subject material for the beginning of a podcast where we're talking about adaptations, because we're going to see his full idea, his full vision for what he wanted this movie to be like. And that's so rare, but it's also going to be a really good point of contrast for when we move on, because 99.99999% of movies that are adapted into things or from things are not done by the original authors. So it'll be really, what I'm really interested as we move through this is to see what from his own book he thought was important and translated well. And we think we'll see it's like, it's very true to the book. It's very true to the movie, is very similar. But there are like one or two bits that I was like, huh, interesting that that was changed just a little bit because he had sole control over that. It would be really interesting to see.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You're right. I almost guarantee every single project we focus on moving forward will be adapted less, strictly. It will
less faithfully,
have more,
maybe.
Yeah, less faithfully.
Yes.
It'll take a lot more liberties in the future. So I think this is an interesting place to start. And we are going to see a lot of dialogue that is exactly the same in the movie.
Which I love.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy how much.
It is. And we'll get over this. We'll get into this much more in detail later on. But it's really interesting to see. That tells you how well the dialogue was written from minute one.
Mm-hmm.
It translates so well to actually spoken dialogue.
Absolutely. So let's just jump into chapter one. First of all, listeners, we hope you're reading with us. But if you're not, you can still enjoy this. No worries. Just for context, you guys, we're covering 9 chapters and 48 pages, which, as you can do the math, means it's only like 2 or 3 pages per chapter. Some of them are 1 page. So These are going to move quickly. So the first chapter is literally about a page total, and it's just introducing us to Camp Green Lake. And the first sentence of the book is, "There is no lake at Camp Green Lake." I love this first sentence. Completely to the point. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I love it.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Oh, well, just immediately. It's not poor Stanley. There is nothing soft or inviting about this place. There's don't expect what you think you should.
No.
There is no lake at Camp Green Lake.
At all. There's absolutely no shade anywhere. And the author says, there is one hammock between 2 trees, the only trees in sight, and no one can sit in the in the hammock because the warden owns the shade.
I think they cut the hammock out.
I think so too. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. I was wondering if it was because we don't want to see her relaxing.
Yeah, maybe so. She's too hard for that, right?
Could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the first page, again, it translates so well. The first chapter of the book translates to the very first scene of the movie. The very first scene of the movie is, what is his name? Barfbag. Mm-hmm. Barfbag purposely getting himself stung by a rattlesnake, or bitten, I should say, by a rattlesnake. Mm-hmm. And he includes the sentence in the first chapter, "Sometimes a camper will try to be bitten by a scorpion or even a small rattlesnake." You don't get bitten by scorpions. That's inaccurate.
Yeah.
Right. You can't get bitten by scorpions.
You get stung.
You would be stung. You get stung. You get bitten by rattlesnakes. Yeah. Tisk, tisk, Lewis S. And I also think it's interesting. It says, then he will get to spend a day or 2 recovering in his tent instead of having to dig a hole. That's not what happens to Barfbag. Barfbag goes straight to the hospital.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think that this sentence says a lot in the book, that he'll get to spend a day or 2 recovering in his tent, and that's preferable to digging a hole. That's how miserable it is. This author constantly is painting a really vivid picture of torture and misery and just unbearable punishment. Yeah. And it's always there. Always. Oh, you get no relief ever.
And we talked in our earlier analysis about like how we enjoyed the fact that the yellow spotted lizards are not a made up danger to keep the kids from running away. They are a very real danger. And that's also how he starts the book. The last 2 sentences of the first chapter are, if you get bitten by a yellow spotted lizard, you might as well go into the shade of the oak trees and lie in the hammock. There is nothing anyone can do to you anymore.
Right. Immediately setting up that danger.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
This place, and the thing is, this is not a place for kids. It's just not.
That is, yeah, that's really the one thing that the first chapter sets up is children shouldn't be around here.
Exactly.
It's incredibly dangerous.
And it will continue to get more dangerous.
Yeah.
So we go into chapter 2, which is just a couple paragraphs. And I like that we'll see if he keeps doing it in the book. I'm not sure if I love it as a one-off, but the author recognizes the reader and says, the reader is probably asking, why would anyone go to Camp Green Lake? Interesting, like, change of point of view and verbiage.
You know,
but
a little break of the fourth wall.
Mm-hmm, I like it, especially if it continues here and there throughout the book. And then we have a direct quote from the author that says, if you take a bad boy and make him dig a hole every day in the hot sun, it will turn him into a good boy. That's almost direct. Not quite.
Yeah. Half of this teeny tiny chapter is almost verbatim into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have that sentence at the end that we all noted in the movie. Stanley was from a poor family. He had never been to camp before.
I know.
And that was the sentence that broke our heart at the beginning, him standing in front of the judge.
I underlined it. And in this next chapter, with that in mind, I put, he is sympathetic right away, just like the movie.
Right away.
So in chapter 3, he's on the bus and he's the only passenger. We've got the driver and a guard, and he's already on his way to Camp Green Lake. The only difference in these first few chapters that I noticed as far as like adaptation was it's told in a little bit of a different order, which makes sense to me. Like, he's on the bus going to Camp Green Lake right away in the book. It makes sense why they would show him with his family at mm-hmm. home with the shoes landing on him, then going to court, then like, I get why they did it, but does anyone have any specific thoughts on them sort of changing the order of revealing information?
I didn't really have any thoughts other than I feel like it made sense in the book. I mean, I feel like in the movie you sort of like need to get to know Stanley a little bit better beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just didn't have any like specific thoughts about it, except that like it was also a good method of telling the story.
I think it works both ways. I think this serves the book. And I think the way the movie did it also.
I did have one question. Do y'all remember him being handcuffed?
I was actually going to ask that question as well. So yeah, for listeners, it does point out, that he's actually handcuffed to his armrest. And they mentioned that a couple times. And I was trying really hard to think back. Did they handcuff him in the movie? And I don't think so. I think I have an image of him crossing his arms over his backpack. I think that's what I remember.
Oh, I think you might be right. I think you're right. That, actually. Yeah.
I definitely don't remember handcuffs. And I noticed just now, I didn't write this down, but I'm realizing we talked about this in the movie and we had some differing opinions on it, but there is no ghost of
Sam. There's no ghost. I wrote that down too. There's no Sam
There's
ghost.
No ghost.
Which makes more sense.
Yeah, yes. But again, super interesting, because that means that the author himself decided, let's throw in a little foreshadowing,
mm-hmm.
which he had chosen not to include in the original book, which is very interesting.
Right.
We also learn in chapter 3, one of the major differences from the book to the movie, which is Stanley Yelnats in the book is overweight.
Yes, that's exactly what I was about to say.
Huge difference. But it's a huge difference. I'm sorry. I really didn't mean to do that. But the author focuses on it quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, he sees it as a big part of Stanley's persona.
Yeah. And it actually makes him more sympathetic because he's bullied at school, even though he's bigger than everyone. Mm-hmm. He's picked on by his teacher, which, by the way, fire her. Listeners, here's a direct quote. On his last day of school, his math teacher, Miss Bell, taught ratios. As an example, she chose the heaviest kid in the class and the lightest kid in the class and had them weigh themselves.
How is this written?
Stanley weighed 3 times as much as the other boys. Mrs. Bell wrote the ratio on the board 3-1, unaware of how much embarrassment she had caused both of them.
Like, unaware? Really?
Really.
Unaware as an adult woman?
This was written in 98. I was just trying to think, like, how much of that could you get away with today?
Right? Not.
That would have been plastered over social media in seconds.
But I am glad we're talking about this because I'm curious. I'm glad you brought it up, Kristen, because I want to know if you think it would have served the movie better or what differences it would have made if they had stayed true to this version of Stanley that's overweight.
It's difficult to imagine anybody other than Shia LaBeouf playing him because he did a wonderful job. I'm trying to imagine. I mean, but we have an overweight kid, armpits overweight, in the movie. Mm-hmm. And you don't see them treat him any differently. we never see, I don't know, I feel like we never see Stanley in a situation in the movie where his weight affects the story. The only time we mm-hmm. see in the book his weight affecting the story is in flashbacks that the movie doesn't include.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would say too. Like, I don't, so far, I mean, we haven't gotten into everything in the book, but I do feel like his weight has not, in the movie, it didn't need to be a central part of the storyline, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't see that it has affected, like Kristen said, anything besides like the lead up to coming to camp. Now, there is a point, and we'll get there, where he basically admits that, you know, he's losing some weight. I think any child would probably start losing weight.
I'm sure they all do.
Yeah, everybody's going to become lean. So I don't think it was a loss.
Yeah, I have a couple sort of differing opinions on this. On one hand, I think that his weight came into play slightly, just in the sense that in the movie, in the sense that Shia LaBeouf at that age was so scrawny that it kind of had the same effect of someone who's overweight. I felt like he wasn't up to par with the other boys because he was smaller. He seemed a little bit like a runt, almost.
Very much. Mm-hmm. Either way, I think it gives you, I think had he been overweight, it would have given you the same impression of a protective feeling mm-hmm. about this kid.
But then I also mm-hmm. want to, we don't need to dive too deep into this, but I think it's something interesting to address, is that pretty people generally get further in this world. They don't have to work as hard for things. And I have to be honest with myself and go, okay, Shia LaBeouf is a sweet looking kid. He's not bad looking. Like, you know, whatever. He has clear skin. He's fine to look, not in a, you know, sexual
way. No, sure. Right? He's, yeah.
And in the film industry, I mean, me and Kristen both are actors, or at least I used to be, but clear skin gets you a lot further than if you're struggling with acne. So in general, looking better, it's just more pleasant for people to watch on screen. And I do wonder if it had been a severely like overweight kid instead of Shia LaBeouf, would I have A, related to him as much and been so sympathetic towards him? I don't know. In the book I am, because I'm not seeing it on a screen. In the book, it makes no difference to me. But I wonder if that played into it, like if they purposefully made that choice, because it's just easier and more pleasant to watch someone who's not overweight. I don't know. You don't see a lot of like title characters in movies that are overweight.
You don't. That's true.
I mean, I think that's typically what's behind casting choices. I think that if this movie were made today, the casting directors would probably be vilified for not
Absolutely.
Casting someone who
I think so.
Fits the body type that was described.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there are people who are overweight who are also looking for lead roles.
Yeah. You know. And they're relating to this character. They're like, oh, for once there's a lead role who's like me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
but
conversely though, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, but would the audience have received it the same way? I don't know.
Right.
I mean,
right.
And that's
if we're being
why
honest.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why someone like Shia LaBeouf was probably chosen.
Well, I was going to come at it from the opposite perspective and also wonder, this is a Disney movie. Holes is a Disney property. Shia LaBeouf, we pointed out in when we were covering the movie, that this was his introducing credit. This was his introduction to feature films. So I think it's also entirely likely that what actually happened was they were looking for a vehicle for their new star that they knew could carry a movie. And they looked at this property and thought, this is a perfect role for him. He doesn't need to be overweight. He can still play this role. I think it's possible that they had Shia first and then found Holes.
I mean, yeah, it was Disney and Shia was already a Disney star, so I can see that.
We know they wanted to build his career up from Even Stevens, so I don't know. It's possible.
Yeah. Okay, so in the interest of moving on, I'm on page 8 now. I'm not sure, Kristen, if you have different pages from me and Chris. Chris and I have the same version of the book, but
that's a good question. Does your page 8 start with supposedly he had a great great grandfather?
Yes.
Great. Okay, that'll make things easier.
So we get to our first introduction to the song the If Only song. And I had first underlined part of this and went, different lyrics?
Because it's a little bit different.
Yes, a little bit.
Yeah, it gets addressed. But readers, the original version of the song in our books is, if only the woodpecker's size, the bark on the tree was just a little bit softer. While the wolf waits below, hungry and lonely, he cries to the moon, if only... We learn later that this is like a translation thing that we're reading and hearing English, but this was originally in Latvian, which we had been talking in our last few podcasts about, like, oh, is he Jewish? Is he not?
Oh, that's
like,
true. Seems Jewish. We were wondering about that.
We've now learned he's Latvian. Yes.
Oh, I also noticed we learn that his understanding of the curse is that his great-great-grandfather stole a pig from a one-legged gypsy. And what I can't remember is, was Eartha Kitt one-legged?
I also noted that. I don't recall that being part of the movie at all.
But it actually, we had that question at the beginning, was why couldn't she go up the mountain by herself? I feel like I remember us having that question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think we just assumed she was elderly. But
yeah. Yeah. But if she had one leg, like, the fair. I don't want to climb a mountain now, and I've got two legs.
Actually, there were a lot of things like that that were very small, but cleared things up for me. Questions I had in the movie where I was like, does that make sense? And just a few sentences in the book made me go, oh, okay, I get it now.
I'm pretty sure I know what you're talking about, and I think I underlined all of them as well, where I was like, oh, this makes sense.
Yes. And something that really hit me hard on page 9 was they're talking about the curse. They're introducing it. And he says, but perhaps that was part of the curse as well. If Stanley and his father weren't always hopeful, then it wouldn't hurt so much every time their hopes were crushed. And I just wrote, nihilism sometimes works, next to that.
You know, so I have to admit, I have always had that viewpoint. And so I highlighted it like as well, because I was like, man, that hits home. Because like, if your expectations are just like so low, you won't be let down, right?
I would like to know how, as a female and not a Yelnats, I ended up with this flippin' curse.
Someone I knew you would relate to this, Kristen. I knew it.
Well, I've been saying for years that I'm cursed and nobody believes me. So I'm a Yelnats. I claim that for myself.
It's true. I tell her, you're not cursed. You're not cursed. I believe a little bit in karma, elements of it. And I think you've had so much bad luck that eventually it's all going to turn around. Once you get going and things start going well, you're going to skyrocket, baby. You've earned it. You've racked it up.
I really have freaking earned it. We'll talk about that later. And speaking of something bad luck, there's a different project that Stanley's father has in the book. In the movie, he is trying to get rid of foot odor. In the book, he's trying to find a way to recycle old sneakers.
Yes, I was going to ask you guys about that as well. Like, I didn't know if I was remembering that wrong, but honestly, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that in the movie, it was just solely focused on like possibly inventing some kind of spray or solution that would get rid of the
stench. Specifically foot odor. Yeah, I think.
Foot odor.
And actually, I think both work. Both are pretty genius ideas. To be able to spray something in your shoe that fixes the odor, awesome. But also to be able to recycle old sneakers into something useful. Like, we all probably get new sneakers if you're using them for work or working out or whatnot, at least every like 3 to 4 years, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know.
More frequently, because I buy cheap ones.
I was going to say, mine are probably more frequent.
Yeah. I'm bougie. I only do cloud shoes.
Ooh la la. Oh. And, well, and this whole chapter is basically covered. It's covering the story of the Yelnats curse. Mm-hmm. And it basically all takes place over the scene that we saw in the movie where the family is sitting down talking about Kiss and Kate Barlow got after their grandfather. He found refuge on God's thumb, but she only kissed the men that she killed.
Yes.
And he was lucky to have survived.
Yep, exactly. We get all of that laid out for us. So we get the introduction of Kiss and Kate Barlow. We get the introduction of the curse, and we'll find out more about all of it later. But that brings us to chapter 4, which is page 11. And again, we're at Camp Green Lake, and we're getting these vivid descriptions of how brutal and dry and just miserable this terrain is.
We learned he'd been on the bus driving for 8 hours.
Yeah.
That hit me differently than in the movie. In the movie, it feels like 2 or 3 hours. Something like, is that how y'all felt about it?
Well, it solidified in my mind that we are out in the desert of West Texas. Like, very little is that remote in Texas other than like that area.
And actually, guys, it's 9 hours. I just looked and read 9 hours to get there, and the guard still has to drive 9 hours back.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Well, I thought what was really interesting was, so like what started his journey to Camp Green Lake, where there is very little water, like they didn't give him enough water on the bus. So like we're already off to a bad start because his mouth is dry and his throat hurts like getting off of the bus. So like, don't expect things to get easier from here. Like, this is like the best you're going to get. It's downhill.
And we get this part about the soda that happens in the movie, but it happens differently. In the book, it says, there must have been a small refrigerator behind his desk because the man in the cowboy hat, a.k.a. Mr. Sir, produced 2 more cans of soda. For a second, Stanley hoped that one might be for him, but the man gave one to the guard and said the other was for the driver. And this is one bit where I think the adaption was really beneficial and improved on this moment a little. It added humor because you can see Stanley, like, trying to sort of get it, and he's like, oh, did you think this was for you? Like, get used to being thirsty. And they just painted a little more like humorously, and I enjoyed that adaptation.
Yeah, it speaks to the chemistry and the really good instincts of both Shia and John Voight.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Oh, and I noticed, I think I remember that we all picked up on the fact that Mr. Sir has a rattlesnake tattoo, and we were wondering whether that was John Voight's or the character's, and we learn in Mr. Sir's introduction that is in the book. He has a rattlesnake tattoo.
Yes. Good catch, because I forgot that we talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was specifically designed by the author.
And talking about how... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. No, you go, because I was going to move
on. Talking about the fact that he's moving on as well, that he's already sympathetic to us. The guard who drives him there complains that he's got 9 hours there and 9 hours back, which is horrific. And it says, Stanley thought about the long, miserable bus ride and felt a little sorry for the guard and the bus driver. Like, this poor, sweet kid is probably dangerously dehydrated. He's just been on this horrific bus ride. He's been handcuffed on a bus that they mention has no air conditioning in the Texas sun, over 100. And he's thinking, oh man, but they have to go back.
Mm-hmm. And this is like an interesting thing too, because we'll get into this later, but like, we are seeing how empathetic Stanley is when he arrives.
Yeah.
And this place will harden you.
Oof. And he gets hard pretty quick. Ew.
Gross. Oh no.
He's a teenage boy. He probably is doing that every morning.
Okay. They have no room for that. They can't. They're sleeping 2 feet away from each other.
You're right. 2 feet apart.
Okay. I had not thought about this aspect of camp. Okay.
Yeah. And they only get 4 minutes per shower. So.
Yeah. We'll get into all the day-to-day.
It's a cold shower at that.
So. A cold shower. Yeah, that's a very good point.
That's the thought behind the cold shower.
Yeah. I don't think you're going to get any excitement in this place, okay?
Stop enjoying yourself.
Y'all, they're too tired. Let's admit it. They are too tired.
For real.
We've all been there.
Oh, he's given the orange cap in the movie, that iconic orange cap that really like bright red orange cap that he comes with, that kind of makes him stand out. That's not included in the book. That's given to him along with everybody else's
hat. Yeah, interestingly enough, it's part of the uniform, which does make more sense. I have a hard time believing that they would let him wear his own cap if no one else, you know, has that. And then they also say, so he's given 2 sets of clothes. He's got the work clothes and the sleep clothes. And disgustingly enough, the sleep clothes after 3 days become your work clothes. So you don't get clean clothes for like a week. And then they give him some yellow socks, and he notes, Stanley wasn't sure if the socks had been yellow originally. So it's all pretty dire. This is pretty nasty. And he says you're to dig one hole each day, including Saturdays and Sundays. They don't even get a day off. Not a single day.
Why would you? You got to find that lipstick tube.
Right? Breakfast is served at 4:30, which means they're waking up at 4 every day. Like, this just gets worse and worse.
Yes, no. I mean, sorry. I'll say this from, like, having worked really long, hot days in Texas. Like, if you're going to beat the heat.
It is the best way to do it.
That is the best way to do it. They'll just go to bed early, right?
Yeah. Like, if they're, this is the most sympathetic they can be to the kids' plight is, like, at least they're letting them dig in the dark. I mean, to be honest, it would be kindest to make the kids nocturnal. Except I think we established
cooler.
But we established, right, that the lizards come out at night, right?
Yes,
so you can't have them
true.
Only dig during the nighttime.
Perhaps I'm just speaking as a late riser myself. If I can, I work evenings usually. And no, I'm not a stripper or a lady of the night, but I do usually work evenings, and I will sleep till 9, you know, if I can. And even then I have to set my alarm to wake up at 9. Like, I'm not someone who wakes up with the sun. So to me, anytime I have to wake up in the dark and start working, which I do have to do sometimes for certain gigs. I work in the event industry, guys, but that's just miserable when I have to do that. Like, being up before the sun, my body's like, this isn't right. You're supposed to be asleep. So you're right. They beat the heat that way. But for my personal taste, it just sounds miserable. And then Mr. Sir says for the second time in this chapter, something he will say several times over again, this isn't a Girl Scout camp.
It's very much his catchphrase.
Yeah. And I want to get into, he mentions this over and over, and he obviously has insecurities as a man. We learn at the end, you know, his real name is Mary, I think.
I'm very curious to see if that's
Marion?
Included.
Yeah, Marion. Yeah. And both him and Mom, both adult men in this book are behaving incredibly harshly towards the boys because they kind of have little man syndrome. Like, I don't know how short they really are, but they are really suffering with self-esteem and feeling like a man. And they're treated a certain way by the warden, and they just continue that cycle. It's almost like a cycle of abuse, really. And they just continue that cycle toward the boys because it's the only thing that makes them feel like a man. Like, manliness is power, right? And I have power over these boys. So I feel like him mentioning this ain't no Girl Scout camp over and over is just him pointing out, like, we're men, and you're going to toughen up and be a man. He has this obsession with manhood.
I think that was something that we brought up in the movie section of the podcast, which is the idea that both of her male Three Stooges sidekicks are here because they need people that they can feel better than. Mm-hmm. And it says a lot that the only people that are quote unquote worse than them or lesser than them on the hierarchy are teenage boys who have been convicted by the law.
Who can't fight back.
Who can't. Exactly.
Okay, so we need to zoom along a little more speedily. We're at chapter 5. This is when we really get into the day-to-day life at camp. And we've already addressed some of this. But I really just wrote here, they're living in tents, which is in the movie, but I actually hadn't thought about how rough that is before. Like, you get out of the sun, and yes, you're in a tent, but there's still no AC. You're sleeping on a cot. And think about this, when you're camping, the floor of the tent is always dirty. You're coming in with dirty shoes. It's hard to keep dirt out of the tent, and multiple boys are living here. So you never have a clean floor, which means you never have clean feet.
Oh, my thought was that it was that these were tents that were pitched in the dirt. Now, in the movie, they have a wood floor, but we're not really, it doesn't say anything like that in the book. I kind of assumed that these were pitched on the dirt, that these are just packed dirt floors.
Oh, you think there's not even like a tarp-like bottom?
Oh.
Why would there be? That's expensive. Tarps ain't free.
Okay.
Yeah, and it does seem like this place is like, let's cut corners any possible way we can.
I'm surprised they give them cots, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and sleeping on cots every night?
For 18 months?
Yeah. Come on. Oh, and I didn't realize. So it says there were 6 large gray tents labeled A, B, C, D, E, or F, and the counselors slept in F. So the counselors are sleeping in tents too.
So, but can we talk about that for a second? Because my impression was all we had was mom in the movies. Like, I actually didn't get the impression that there were very many more people at the camp besides, like, counselors and staff.
No, that's a great point.
That's a great point, especially because they note later that mom is the only person delivering water to all of the blocks. So what are all the other counselors doing?
Yeah, no, it's you're right. It says Stanley was assigned to D tent. Mr. Pendansky was his counselor, which absolutely does
imply there are other counselors.
Yeah.
Great point.
It also notes he's supposed to have a beard in
thick, it's curly and black.
Yeah. But the inclusion is instead of the perpetual zinc on his nose, which I kind of wonder if that was Tim Blake Nelson's idea, because it's so mwah. It's so stupid and good. But they instead note his nose was badly sunburned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's a little more preventative in the movie.
And, you know, I remember mentioning on our movie podcast that Mr. Pendansky starts off seeming like a really safe space, like he cares about the kids, and it quickly turns. I will say in the books, it does not turn as quickly as the movie. So far, having read 100 pages, he still, for the most part, seems like a really safe space and a person who wants to help these boys. So I'm interested to see how much they, like, dive into the descent of his, like, bigotry and power issues.
I will say we get the first glimpse, and this is probably the same as the movie.
The Zero thing?
Yes.
We've seen him pick on Zero. Yeah.
So he picks on Zero, you know, four pages into us, like, getting to know mom.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, the same exact line. You know why his name's Zero? Because there's nothing inside his head.
And we'll skip forward to that real quick, because I do want to comment that I noticed that and was like, oh, Mr. P, what are you doing? But then the book adds, he smiled and playfully shook Zero's shoulder. And it did make me think, well, okay, is it just kind of a joke? Like, playfully shook his shoulder, smiled. Like, I got a little bit of a different feeling than the movie. A little bit like, hey, can I get you to talk somehow? Hello? Like, sort of like he's frustrated, like, is there anything in your brain? Like, come on, buddy. But maybe
I don't know.
Not.
It sounds like abuse to me. It sounds like, let me, like, verbally abuse you and then give you a comforting pat on the shoulder to where you, like, can't be mad at me.
Well, I think it's because we're not seeing all of the author chose not to include all of those little, like, micro expressions or thoughts. And we're not seeing what we see in the movie, which is Zero's expression of, like, I am not amused. Do not touch me.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? Actually, we can just skip forward because we don't have all the time in the world. So the only thing I want to mention that would have been between those last two things we were talking about is that we've got Squid as more of a prominent character now. And I feel like in the movie, Squid.
We never even learned his name.
Yeah, I didn't even know that was his name.
We don't even know his name. He's just a guy who might have one or two lines in the crew. But but in the book, listeners, Squid is basically like number three in the hierarchy. It goes X-ray, Armpit, Squid, Zigzag, Magnet, Zero. And
did you memorize that?
No. I was just thinking my way through it, but Squid is actually like a pretty prominent player in this group. So you'll hear a lot more about him, listeners. But yeah, so we go over to Mr. Pendansky picking on Zero, and I'm open to both interpretations. I'm not really sure what's going on there. Maybe
no,
I
agree with you here because it has this phrase, or I'm sorry, it has the word playfully. He smiled and playfully shook Zero's shoulder. Zero said nothing. That doesn't sound aggressive.
Right. I'm like, is he just trying to bring something out of him? But perhaps in these 100 pages we've read, because we're doing two episodes today, guys, but in these 100 pages we've read, I haven't seen anything else from mom that has seemed abusive. So maybe I'm willing to write it off because of that, but we'll see how his character develops. I don't know.
It's also very possible, again, that once the actors got on set, they realized, like, we need something to fill this space. And they realized what we've realized, which is, why does an adult willingly come here to work in this place? It's so they can feel big.
Yeah, exactly. Stanley meets the group. The hierarchy is pretty quickly established. Stanley's at the bottom right away. They mention Armpit is pretty big, but in the book, Stanley is even bigger. And then we have this, direct quote, as he watched the boy turn and walk away, aka Armpit, he couldn't for the life of him figure out why anyone would want to be called Armpit, which I was wondering in the movie. In a way, it made him feel a little better about having to sleep in a cot that had been used by somebody named Barfbag. Maybe it was a term of respect, and he's right. I wrote so many times, Stanley is very astute in this moment. He does understand what's going on.
He's very perceptive when it comes to like chain of command and power issues. He understands even like in certain times, like what to say and not say to like Mr. Sir and Mom and the warden, we find out too. He knows when to hold his tongue.
Do you think that that's something we saw in the movie as well? That he's aware of, for lack of a better term, his place?
Not really. I think this is something we only get from the book because we're in his head in a way that we're not able to be when we're watching the movie. He doesn't seem unaware in the movie, but I don't really get this sense that he's in tune with these power dynamics and what he should and shouldn't do necessarily. He just kind of seems to be floating along.
Yeah. I wonder if that's something that comes, obviously it's because we're inside his head, but I wonder if that's something that comes from him being from a poorer family. I think that's something that you have to be aware of as a survival mechanism when you don't have wealth to protect you.
So we move on to chapter 6. We already talked about the 4-minute showers, which is just wild. And they're cold showers. Yep.
We learn about his first night, the showers, the bed. I remember you described like the way the Foley sounded so disgusting when they like spooned the food onto his plate. They describe it. The meat was brown and the vegetables had once been green.
Yeah.
Everything tasted pretty much the same.
Oh, I wanted to make a quick note, even though we don't have much time left, but these 4-minute showers, someone mentioned earlier, I think Armpit mentioned that the spigot for your water canteen is next to the shower. And it occurred to me that if your shower shuts off while you're still like soaping up, which was his fear, you could just fill your canteen with the water spigot and like rinse yourself off and do that over and over to extend your shower, right?
You could, although do they have, well, no, actually that can't be right because otherwise they would just keep their shower going. So they must not be in control of the water.
But how do they fill their canteen then? I mean, like he said, the spigot was next to the shower for the canteen.
Like outside of the shower?
Let me find the quote.
Because then you'd have to walk naked.
He says, there's a water spigot on the wall of the shower stall.
Oh.
Oh, no. Well, that's true. In both the book and the movie, he goes, because he goes to Armpit and says, can I fill up my canteen?
Yeah.
Where do I fill up my canteen? And then he gets, you know, shoved over.
Right.
That's a good point. I kind of assumed that there was somebody there whose job it was to turn the spigot, because if they could take longer showers, they would.
I just thought that might be a workaround. But anyways.
No, that'd be smart.
Stanley had never been one to leave food on his plate, no matter how it tasted. So we talked about how he grew up poor, even though the food is gross. He would never leave food on his plate. I know a lot of people who grew up very, very strapped that are like that. They just, out of habit, never leave food.
You find that very believable. Last full meal is going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is when we learn for the first time in the book why he was sent here.
He stole Sweet Feet's shoes.
And he has this great quote that again, we're not privy to in the movie. He thought it was kind of funny. Nobody had believed him when he said he was innocent. Now when he said he stole them, nobody believed him either.
Yeah, I highlighted that too. Exactly. And he has a poster of Clyde on his wall, which just, oh, more sympathetic.
Which we saw in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says his hero thought he was a no good, dirty, rotten thief.
And we even note, in spite of everything, when Stanley found out that Sweetfeet was going to be there, he was actually excited about the prospect of meeting his hero.
You're right. That's so cute.
This I wanted to note real quick, because we see like a little look into Stanley's last day at school before everything goes to crap. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we note that he's getting bullied. And when he gets, what I remember is that we had a discussion about, I think, Chris, you had brought up the fact when we were discussing the movie that you weren't sure why he runs, right? Stanley gets hit by the sneakers. He's
that was me.
Sneakers.
Yeah.
You brought this up. Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah. Okay, so it was Allison. Yes. Yeah, he sees the sneakers and then he immediately starts running. Mm-hmm. And the book gives us a perfectly logical explanation in a sense. Yeah. I mean, it addresses it. He says, thinking back now, he wasn't sure why he ran. Maybe he was in a hurry to bring the shoes to his father, because it makes perfect sense. You have another pair of shoes for your dad to experiment on. Or maybe he was trying to run away from his miserable and humiliating day at school. But then, of course, we now have a perfectly logical reason as to why he is caught running with stolen shoes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. One of those instances we referenced earlier. And readers, I mean, well, I'm calling you readers, if you haven't read the book, Stanley says he couldn't help but think there was something special about the shoes, that they just fell from the sky on him. And his father is an inventor trying to find a way to recycle shoes. This seems serendipitous. And so, yeah, he's like excited to show his father these unique shoes. He doesn't know what's going on, but he's like, this must be fate.
But, you know, it was fate. Like, if y'all really think about it, like, their luck never would have turned around if Stanley hadn't been sent to Camp Greenlee.
That was, mm-hmm. I'm so glad you said that, because I was thinking that as well. Because later on, much later on, Ilya Yelnats, who's, like, you know, wandering around in America after he has messed up Madame Zeroni's chances of getting up the hill, he's like, well, what do I do? Do I just like wander up to random people in America to break the curse, to like hope I find her son? Like, once he's lost track of her, he has no way to break the curse anymore.
Yeah. Which also was more, gave us more context. I was like, oh, he just forgot and never thought about it again. And we'll talk about that when we get to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
That gave us more context. I wanted to ask you guys, his mother, and we see this a little bit in the movie, but his mother says, you don't need a lawyer, just tell the truth. And I want to ask, the truth is that shoes fell from the sky on his head. And that is unbelievable. So do you think, and Chris, you're a parent, so we'll start with you. Do you think this is good or bad advice? Because generally I believe in telling the truth, but in a legal setting where the truth is kind of unbelievable, what would you tell your kid?
Well, I'll tell you the answer. You always need a lawyer. You always need a lawyer. Like, I don't care
that
if you're
absolutely
innocent.
True. Absolutely true.
You always need a lawyer to navigate the system. I mean, and the more you become involved with the legal world, the more that you understand that things don't always turn out the way they're supposed to. And innocent people get sentenced all the time. Mm-hmm. I hate to say that, but it happens. Our system is broken. So yes, you always need a lawyer. Don't care what the situation is.
Especially because I'm going to reiterate from the, after having read the book, it says, you know, the judge called Stanley's crime despicable. He said there was an opening and that the discipline of the camp might improve Stanley's character. It was either that or jail. And the judge advised them to make a quick decision because vacancies don't last long at Camp Greenlake. I'm going to reiterate, I think this guy's on the take. I'm convinced that the warden is paying him off a little bit to send kids to Camp Greenlake.
Yeah.
Am I crazy in saying that I think I'm not sure. No, I'll
You're
pose
crazy.
The question.
I don't know.
I'm not sure what I would choose. Would you rather, as an adult, go to Camp Greenlake or jail?
I circled this.
Jail.
We don't know. Well, first of all, yes, jail.
Yeah, jail.
Secondly, we don't know what the alternative sentence time might have been. It's not necessarily true that it would be 18 months of jail or 18 months at Camp Greenlake.
Also seems like it. How old is he? Do we know in the book how old he is?
I want to say it said 14. Did I make that up?
I was actually going to ask y'all as well.
There's
Maybe
no way he was. This is like a basic like theft issue. There's no way he was tried as an adult, okay? He's not going to, like, adult jail. He's going to juvenile detention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, like, not that that's not scary in its own way, mm-hmm. but it's not prison. Okay. So, like, Camp Green Lake or Juvie.
Which, yeah. again, is why I think this judge is on the take, because it's very much implied that the judge tells them, well, either you send him there or he's going to jail. And they're not lawyers, so of course they don't know any better.
Yep.
So we're on chapter 7. We learn that, so this is basically caveman's first dig. That's where we're at. You have to have it, you know, 5 feet long, 5 feet wide, and the shovel has to lay flat across the bottom in any direction. And again, like we said with the movie, Stanley says, what are we supposed to be looking for? Which is very astute of him. They're like, nothing, you're building character. Ba-ba-da-ba-da. He smiled for once in his life. It paid to be overweight. That's a difference in the book. He uses his body weight to push down the shovel and make it easier, which is smart. And then we just get into this really, really educated description of digging holes and the blisters that form on your hands. And this continues for chapters and chapters, like the effect it has on Stanley physically to be digging these holes. And I really feel like this author has dug several holes before. What do y'all think? That he paints this so, so believably. Like, I have dug holes physically like this. And he is so spot on with his description of what happens to your hands and your body and your legs and everything.
Absolutely. I mean, he definitely did it firsthand, whether he had done it previously in his life or like did research for the novel. He definitely,
I was gonna say,
has.
I wonder if he like went out and just dug himself a 5 foot hole just to see what it's like. And it, I love that the description of digging the hole fully takes about like 10 full pages, which for, or like 15 pages, which for this book, which moves very quickly, is a very long time, but it's because that's how long it feels for him to be digging this hole.
You mean because we're like going back and forth with the flashbacks at the
same time? Like it's meant to feel like, like he's so exhausted. Time is standing still.
It feels like forever. You're right.
Yeah, it feels like forever. Yeah. Like 10 pages is a very long time for this particular book to stay on any subject.
So we get our first flashback with his great-great pig-stealing grandfather. And one difference here, which I don't want to talk about too long in the interest of time, but I'm sure y'all noticed, he's actually friends with Madame Zeroni. This isn't like he sought her out just to get help to win this girl's heart.
No,
they've
I wrote that down too. They've been friends for a while.
Mm-hmm. And he just mentions this and she wants to help him. So thoughts on this whole flashback? Chris, you want to go first?
Well, I mean, I thought it was... I mean, other than that, it did feel like it was pretty similar to the movie. I mean, well, again, said, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, to start us on something, she says Miria's head is as empty as a flower pot. And I thought, am I missing something? A flower pot isn't empty. It has flowers in it. Like, what do you mean empty as a flower pot?
Maybe she, I assumed she meant an empty flower pot.
Yeah, that's what I, a hollow, empty flower pot is what I had imagined.
Yeah, like if you, I guess if you said like her head's as empty as a bowl, you wouldn't be like, well, you can put cereal in bowls. Like you can put flowers in flower pots, but they don't come.
Oh, I know you girls will love this too, though. He says, but she's beautiful. And I have to read this quote to the listeners because yes, Madame Zeroni, so is a flower pot, aka beautiful. Can she push a plow? Can she milk a goat? No, she is too delicate. Can she have an intelligent conversation? No, she is silly and foolish. Will she take care of you when you are sick? No, she is spoiled and will only want you to take care of her. So she is beautiful. So what? And makes like a noise.
So she does in a way foreshadow his wife, because that is something that they do make sure to mention later on, is that the wife that he does end up choosing in America, not to spoil everything.
Yeah.
But she is willing to work hard on their farm. She doesn't abandon him when he says, I'm cursed. She says, and so what? Like, we're going to like figure this out. So it was interesting that she pointed out everything that was wrong with this girl, Myrna, that he would eventually find in another woman.
Yes. And I was here for it. I have a personal like chip on my shoulder with women like that who are, you know, just extremely delicate, pretty, pretty princesses that don't think they need to work hard or pull their weight. And it's like, what are you offering in a relationship? What are you bringing to the table? Like, I've had roommates in the past where I felt like I was the man of the house. Like, they didn't want to take out the trash. They didn't want to do hard things. And I just, I have a thing about that. So I love that Madame Zeroni is like, you should value intelligence and hard work and someone who will take care of you when you're sick and isn't just into themselves and spoiled and wanting you to treat her like a princess, you know? So
I also noted that the movie, since we're trying to focus on the adaptations, I noticed that the movie aged up both Ilya and Mira.
A lot, yeah.
Very, so Ilya is Stanley's age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... Ilya is 15 when he falls in love with Mira, and Mira is 14, would turn 15 in 2 months. And we had a discussion, I distinctly remember, about how long did we think he was carrying that pig up every single day. According to the, like, we're given an exact timeline in the book. It is 2 months to the day that he carries that pig up the mountain.
Right, you're right. That makes sense. And actually, I like this better in the book. I understand why they changed it for the movie. But I like this better because he's Stanley's age. So it's more of a direct, like, parallel to Stanley finding himself going into a man.
Very much so, because he mentions he was just a 15-year-old kid. He thought nothing of the curse because eternity didn't seem much longer than a week from Tuesday.
Exactly.
He also says he liked Madame Zeroni and would be glad to carry her up the mountain. He would have done it right then and there, but he wasn't yet strong enough, because every day he carries the pig up, he gets a little bit stronger. And then immediately afterwards, and I wrote in the margins, strength built through labor, because the very next thing we see is the phrase, Stanley was still digging. We have these ancestors, the great-great-grandfather and Stanley, both of whom are learning that the only way to build strength comes through hard, hard labor.
Yes. And again, one of the things that makes more sense now, because I was like, how could you just forget about Madame Zeroni and just, like, completely overlook this curse thing? Well, he's 15. He's 15.
Yep, that makes more sense.
In the movie, I mean, how old would we say she was 18? She looked 18 or 19 in the movie. How old would we say he was? 20, 22, 21?
Oh, my memory.
I definitely thought early 20s.
Yeah, I would have said like 25.
Well. Yeah.
It's definitely a purposeful age up.
Yeah. On the day of Mira's 15th birthday, Elia's pig weighed over 50 stones. What is this measuring system?
A stone is an archaic form of measurement used in the UK. It's 14 pounds. 14 pounds to one stone.
Is one stone. So 50 times 14. Anyone down for some quick math? Is that 700?
It's a little bit over 500. I will say it doesn't say 50 stone, though. It does say 750, 50 stones.
Right?
700.
I was right. Okay, 700. Yeah. So that's a really, really fat pig, you guys.
It's a big old pig.
That's super fat.
But in the movie, did we get into the fact that, like, on her birthday, he didn't take the pig up the mountain?
No, we didn't. It's not mentioned at all.
We need to talk about that.
So that's the only day out of 2 months that he failed to take the pig up the mountain. It ends up actually being the difference in him taking this woman as his wife and going to America. And forgetting about Madame Zeroni.
I was going to say, in the movie, he only has one failure. It's that he forgets to bring her up there. Uh-huh. In the book, he has two failures. Yes.
And I think... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Keep going.
I was just going to say, I think we're led to believe that because the pigs ended up weighing the same, the only difference was he didn't take the pig up that one more day. It was just going to barely weigh more than the other. So, fatal mistake. And again, we get more clarity from the book now. Like you said, Chris, like, this makes more sense why the pig didn't win.
Yeah, the pig, I don't know if we have actually spelled it out, but reason that the pigs weigh exactly the same is that Ilya was supposed to take the pig up the mountain that day as well, but he didn't want to because he didn't want to smell like a pig when he proposed to her. So on this one single day, he neglects to do what he's told, which again digs into this idea of fables. Like we talked about early on, that this is kind of a fable in a sense, right? The idea of if you're not obedient, if you don't follow the rules, even once, sometimes bad things can happen to you. You're supposed to follow the rules.
But I would also argue that it would have been a bigger curse to marry someone that dumb.
Honestly.
That's just like, I mean, how different would his entire family be?
Yeah. That's true. Because we are, we see the Yelnatses are bad. They have terrible luck. But other than that, we're told they're smart. They're ingenuitive. They're clever. They're kind. They're really good people aside from the fact that they're cursed.
Yeah.
Maybe that wouldn't have been the case. I think you're right, Chris.
I agree. And also thank you for clarifying those things, Kristen, for the readers. So we're still in the flashback. And basically, the father, Miria's father, says to Elia, "I used to think you were a good-for-nothing book reader." Oh, and ouch. I feel called out. But I see you could be an excellent mud wrestler. We go on and on with this flashback. A lot of it is the same as the movie, just more detailed. And I just wanted to point out that Miria gets her choice. And even though Elia is obviously like way more attractive and romantic and smart than Igor, she says, "Oh, I know. I'll think of a number between 1 and 10 and I'll marry whoever gets it closest," just like the movie. And Igor guesses 10 from 1 to 10, which is just the worst
such a
possible guess.
Bad, yeah, bad strategy.
But then we go back to Shia. Oh, I'm always going to do that. You know, well, it's Stanley digging his hole. And he's got his first lunch, which is a bologna sandwich, potato chips, and a large chocolate chip cookie, which I thought, for how horribly this, you know, camp has been painted, it's just vile. It's not a bad sack lunch.
It's that's a bad. Much nicer lunch than we've seen dinner.
Yeah, honestly, I was thinking that sounds really good when I was reading it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and they have to go to the toilet, like, in holes, even number two. And
I think they did mention that in the movies.
They did.
And they said pick a hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess I didn't think about this in the movie, but they don't have toilet paper. So for going number two.
In clothes that are not going to be washed for 3 days.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Tear a piece off of your undershirt, I guess. Good luck. Ugh.
So we're back to the flashback. Homeboy is going to America, forgets to obviously carry Madame Zorni at the mountain. I will skip this because Kristen sort of already addressed it, but it makes more sense that he was depressed. He immediately boarded a ship to America, kind of on Madame Zeroni's advice previously. And she said, "You should go to America like my son." Well, he does it immediately because he's sad and he doesn't think till he's on the ship, "Oh gosh, I forgot to carry her up the mountain." But in that day and age, he's on a several month voyage. There's nothing he can do now. He's gone.
But I like that in the book, we see the regret, whereas in the movie, we just see, you know, he's sleeping and her voice is like, "You and your family will be cursed for all eternity."
Yes.
But in the book, we actually see, you know, he's so sad that he is heading out. He's in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And then he suddenly remembered his promise and he felt terrible. And I love that, again, we see the callback to them being friends, which was not really a thing that we saw in the movie. He just says he wasn't afraid of the curse, but he felt bad because he knew she wanted to drink from the stream before she died.
Yeah. He makes it very clear that it's not about the curse. It's absolutely about like, "Oh, well, she just asked this one thing of me and I wanted to help her. I wish I could have taken her up the mountain."
Yeah.
So Elia, like his descendant, is also kind of an unusually empathetic 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I feel like me and Kristen are running the show. We're on page 37. Chris, what is the next thing you wanted to talk about?
So the next thing I was really going to talk about was on page 38. First of all, I thought it was interesting that his cap was stained with blood from his hands. So we got a little bit more of a visceral look at what digging is doing to his body, like cutting him up.
Mm-hmm.
But then we go into when Elia gets to America and he meets Sarah and the life that they're building together, which I don't think we got in the movie.
No.
So, no, that's a very interesting difference.
Yeah. And so I really liked actually hearing that he gets to America, finds a woman, as we've mentioned earlier, who is willing to work, has brain cells.
Yes.
And he actually shares with her, you know, "I'm a little concerned that the reason why we're not doing well is because I didn't carry this old woman up a mountain and you should leave me." And she goes, "Nah, I'm good. I'm going to to stay with you. But sing me that song that you were talking about. And this is where we find out, you know, it rhymes in Latvian, which is probably, I guess that's probably the difference in the lyrics in the book versus the movie. I think in the movie, they're a little more, they make a little more sense in English and feel a little more lyrical than they do here. Which...
Well, she changes it though. It says, Sarah changed the words of the pig lullaby so that they rhymed.
Okay.
And every night she sang it to little Stanley. So she was like, I don't know Latvian, but if you're going to sing this in English, I'm going to make it rhyme. So that's when it becomes, if only the woodpecker sighs, the bark on the tree was as soft as the skies. She makes
and that is the version that we get in the movie, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And we also learn that Sarah is, which is just awesome progenitor, she's the one who comes up with the tradition of naming all the firstborn children, or the firstborn males, Stanley, because she very cleverly notices that Yelnats is Stanley backwards.
Yes. So we get back to Stanley digging his hole. He's finally at the end, and he's trying to get out of his hole, which we see briefly in the movie. He, like, can't get out, and it's funny. But in the book, it says his arms were too weak to lift his heavy body. And I never thought about that. After physically exerting yourself that much, I know what it's like to have your arms like jello. I know you guys do too. So imagine trying to pull yourself out of a hole that's barely taller than you are and your arms are jello. So again, we're just getting this really vivid painting of how rough it is. And he's really smart in the book to get around that. It says using his shovel, he dug 2 footholds in the hole wall so that he could step on them and go out, which I thought was kind of clever.
What I also thought was really interesting, like in his shifting character, was mom giving him the opportunity to have a ride back to camp and him saying, I'll walk.
That is definitely not included in the movie, is it?
No.
I hear you on that. I highlighted that thinking just, is this his only kind of like, we see this in Zero, actually everybody in this book has their own way of defying the system and seizing any power they can. So in that moment, Stanley's only way to seize power, he has to dig the hole. He can't go to sleep or relax or eat until he's done digging the hole. But if given an option, do you want to ride back or not? He can say no. He has agency. Oh, and he sucks up his last bit of saliva and spits.
I was about to talk about the spitting.
Yes, go for it, Kristen.
He learns that it's over the course of him digging his hole, he sees everybody else spit into the hole, and he learns that it's kind of a ritual. And we're not really given insight into why all the boys perform this ritual of spitting into their hole when they're done with it. Like, it's maybe it's something, you know, they feel proud of having dug the hole. Maybe it's like a tiny little FU to the warden and their counselors, but either way, it's something that even if he doesn't know why he does it, he decides, like, I'm going to take part in this ritual that all of them have.
Yes. Which is, again, him understanding power dynamics. And
that's a good point.
Starting to get the lay of the land. Okay, this is what we do. This is how to survive.
So I think that's, Allison, I think that's a really good point, because I think you've pointed that out, right, that in the movie, he kind of, like, haplessly stumbles his way into, like, things kind of working out for him. And I think you're right that in the book, we actually see, no, he's paying close attention. He understands what's going on around him. And it's just that he's very quiet. And so in the movie, you can't translate that into understanding his thoughts.
Right. So we get to chapter 8, and we just have, I believe, 7 pages left, just chapter 8 and 9. So we won't make this too long, listeners, but we really want to get every bit of content here. So let's see. We start getting descriptions, like a detailed description of the yellow-spotted lizards. And they've got big red eyes, which actually means the skin around their eyes is red, making them look red. And black teeth and a milky white tongue. And y'all, that's terrifying.
Those are demonic lizards.
Yeah.
It's really gross.
Horrific. Yeah. And they just reiterate that you'd be dead if you got close enough to count all their spots. And I wanted to point out the last sentence here is they eat small animals, insects, certain cactus thorns, and the shells of sunflower seeds. So does Mr. Sir know this? Is he doing it intentionally? Does he care? What are your thoughts?
I don't know that he's smart enough to know that that's what he's doing.
It's pretty neglectful.
Like, yeah.
If he does know, damn.
I agree with Chris. I don't give him credit for knowing that. But again, this is an in- well, first of all, this is obviously foreshadowing. But secondly, this gives us insight into something that we never really knew in the movie, which is why at the end of the movie do all of these lizards appear out of nowhere in Stanley's hole?
Yep.
Oh, you're right. I didn't think of that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because of the ditch.
Because and, there are sunflower seeds.
Right. Readers, we're not there yet. But, you know, when they throw the bag to Stanley and it empties, that's the same hole where he found the tube, right?
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep. Oh, my gosh. Well, well recognized. Okay. So chapter 9, which is the last chapter we'll cover in this episode.
He gets his nickname.
He does get his nickname.
And he, on the first day at camp, whereas in the movie, it takes him a couple days.
Mm-hmm. That is a difference I wanted to talk about, which I think we can go into more in the next episode. But they immediately stand up for him. His first day at camp, it's that scene in like the rec room or, you know, like the chill lounge. Mm-hmm. And it does say nearly everything in the room was broken. The TV, the pinball machine, the furniture, even the people looked broken with their worn out bodies sprawled over the various chairs and sofas. Very good description.
Mm-hmm.
And we get this guy that is kind of unnamed. They call him the Lump in this book. But, you know, Stanley trips over him. They have an altercation. And immediately X-Ray steps in and says, you don't want to mess with the caveman. So like Kristen said, this is where we get his nickname for the first time on the first. Well, his technically his second day. But, you know, his first day digging holes. And Armpit jumps in. The caveman's cool. And everyone jumps into his defense. And again, we'll go into this in the next episode, but I did notice that the hierarchy isn't necessarily changed yet. He gets respect, but it's much later that he starts stepping forward in line and getting more respect in other ways. So this is mm-hmm. developed differently in the books. I don't know why I said books plural.
In the book, we also note that he doesn't realize at first that caveman refers to him.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. He thinks it's Lump.
Yeah. He thinks he hears them talking about like, hey, man, you don't want to mess with caveman. He's like, OK, oh, fine. Yeah, I guess okay, I won't mess with caveman, whoever that is.
So true. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, you hear this refrain throughout the book. The first hole's the hardest. And they're always like, nope, the next hole after the one you just dug is always the hardest.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do go into that more later. And it's such a beautiful like. It's just really deep. I think we've all felt that.
Absolutely.
And so then on page 45, X-Ray says, well, they're talking about, you know, how the second hole is the hardest and blah, blah, blah. And X-Ray is like, well, the fun is gone once you get to the second hole because every kid in the world wants to dig a big, great hole to China, right? And Stanley doesn't get it, but I totally do. Did y'all ever try to dig a hole to China?
Actually, like, well, I didn't try to dig a hole to China, but I really enjoyed the idea of like accomplishing something like digging a hole. So I actually did like for fun. I mean, that's what you do when you go to the beach, right?
Yeah.
Like, when you're a kid, you take a little pail and a shovel and you start digging.
Yes.
So I relate to that. But I, as an adult, I relate to Stanley where I'm like, oh, come on. Who wants to dig for fun?
Did they mention that in the movie? Did X-Ray have that little moment of saying,
yeah,
I wanted to dig a hole to China. Yeah, I don't remember that.
But Kristen, did different. You ever do that? Like, was that just me? I tried to dig several holes to China. I thought I would hit it if I dug deep enough.
Oh, no, I wasn't trying to go to China. I think I knew I wouldn't get there. But, you know, a hole's an accomplishment regardless. You know, every kid has dug a hole. Absolutely. True.
So,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to get to the letter.
The letter is what I was going to talk about as well.
Go for it. I was just going to guide us there. You go for it.
Well, all I was going to say was one thing I was really hoping for in the book is a rationalization of why he lies to his mother about his experience. Because in the movie, we get basically the same letter, right? Like, I'm going swimming. I'm enjoying canoeing with the boys or whatever. I've made friends. And in the book, he also lies to his mom. But I was hoping for, since we have access to his thoughts, more rationalization as to why he's not honest with her about what he's going through.
Oh, well, I just thought it was sort of understood that he was so empathetic that he was like sparing her feelings. But
well,
he
says, I don't want her to worry about me, he explained. Because Zero was standing behind him reading the letter.
He does say that.
So I felt
it's that simple.
It seemed simple to me. And of course, he thought Zero was reading.
Mm-hmm. LOL.
But.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. The concern that I had in the movie was that we never see them take a look at the, remember we discussed this, that we never see the counselors like read the boys' letters to see what's going out or not.
Yeah.
We see him write the letter and then take it directly to the
post. But I think
he's
literally just sparing his mom's feelings.
I don't think he's putting it on for the counselors.
Like, I think he feels bad that his parents are so poor and they couldn't do anything to help him. And it's not their fault and it's not his fault. But he doesn't want them to have the burden of worrying. And he knows on some really perceptive level how much parents worry about their kids. And he's sparing them.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, I'm sorry. I want to go back to the moment where we were told that they couldn't afford to get him a lawyer.
Oh, yeah.
He would have a court-appointed lawyer.
You're right.
So, sorry. Just wanted to bring that up for a second. So, anyways.
So, the end of this chapter, and almost the end of this episode, is Zero talks and asks Caveman if the shoes had red X's on the back. And he does it out of nowhere. He's just, you know, supposedly looking like he's reading the letter. He's not. But he's right there. And he says, did the shoes have red X's on the back? And he says they did. And we don't get anything else from that, but we know what happens. And then Armpit says, come on, Caveman, dinner. Squid, you coming, Caveman? So we know he's got his nickname. He's semi-accepted. And we know that Zero has recognized that he's the one who sent him there.
Well, did y'all notice in the movie, it's noted Zero doesn't talk. That's right. Not really a plot point that we get in the book.
Yeah, so there was a line, I wish I had highlighted it, somewhere earlier it said that, like, it keeps saying Zero said nothing and Zero hardly said anything. Like, they keep talking about how quiet he is, but I do see what you're saying in the sense that no one was like, whoa, Zero's talking. Like they
because Right, because in the movie, when Zero asks, did the shoes have red X's on them, they're it's like, at the dinner table with all the boys, and they all go, you got Zero to talk. And that's absent, yeah.
I actually, as far as adaptations go, I think was a good move for the movie.
Yeah, I absolutely. Think so
too. Yeah, he squashes a lot of conversations that happened over the course of a while together, which I think was very clever.
Well, in the interest of time, I think we should end this right here. Also, because Allison has to go to the restroom. Really
as
badly.
Does Chris.
Okay. As does Kristen.
So, thank you guys. This is so much fun. We're going to keep having fun. When you guys hear us next, we'll be going into chapters 11 through whatever the next 50 pages are. We'll see y'all soon. And we still don't have a catchphrase, but bye.
Dig it up. Digging up.
Stay away from yellow spotted lizard. We're not doing that again.
Thanks so much for listening. If you have the time, guys, please rate and review us. It would mean the world. It bumps us up in the algorithm as a new podcast. It's huge. Also, word of mouth is going to be the biggest way to share this podcast. So if you know any decrepit millennials that need a little slice of happiness in their life, a little bump of nostalgia, please, please share with them. We would super appreciate it. All right. Tune in soon for the next episode. We love you.